Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's no easy way to tell you this, but nobody really knows what's going on with the economy. Wall Street clearly thinks everything's fine, but the Fed's worried about inflation. The job market is still lousy and retailers are going under. But hey, happy Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday. It is the 2nd of May today. You don't have to be an economist to know it's a bad thing when there are more jobs lost than created. We find ourselves in that predicament today for the 4th month in a row. The economy had 20,000 fewer jobs at the end of April than there were at the beginning. Today's jobs report capped the trifecta for the week. The Fed cut interest rates Wednesday despite fears of higher food and energy prices. We learned that same morning that growth in first quarter gross domestic product was an anemic 0.6%. The unspoken theme there is a familiar one, the credit squeeze. Central banks have all but been giving money away to convince other banks there's money to be had. Today, they launched their most coordinated effort yet. The Fed joined with the European Central Bank to pump billions more dollars into the banking system. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, is here to explain. Hiya, Bob.
Hello, Kai. I hope I can make it all clear for you.
Yeah, you know, that's funny, because me too. We have talked, you and I, in fact, about signs, indications that the credit squeeze was loosening.
Hints.
And now here we have the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States doing this morning. And what are we to make of it?
Well, you already know that the Fed's been making tens of billions of dollars in loans available to the banking system. Well, today it's basically admitting that these big institutions are just being stubborn about this, that they're not lending to each other still. Basically, they still don't trust each other. They remain worried about the exposure that they could put themselves in to these bad mortgage loans.
Powerful as it is, then, what can the Fed do?
Well, the Fed keeps telling these banks, okay, look, come to our lending window. Instead, we'll give you the money that you need to make loans to businesses and individual borrowers. They're really finding it difficult to find the loans they want right now. Well, this time the Fed is going to be boosting the total of emergency reserves that it's offering to U.S. banks to $150 billion in the month ahead. That compares to about $100 billion it supplied in the past month.
Bob, I don't understand, though. With all this money that's already out there, shouldn't we just be flooded with liquidity?
Ah, that's the big money question here. There is some thought that the banks might be hoarding some of this cash, or to put it in more polite terms, they're sitting on their reserves, okay? Maybe it's just taking a little longer than the Fed had been hoping to top off their reserves. There's one new estimate that when all is said and done here, the banking system is going to end up needing about $333 billion of new capital. And that study figures that something over $200 billion has been raised already.
So we're about two-thirds of the way through, right?
Possibly.
Okay.
The other thing is that the weapons available to the Fed are really blunt instruments, if you will. I spoke today to John Sylvia. He's chief economist at Wachovia. And he points out the Fed can flood the banks with all the money it wants, but it can't make the banks lend.
What the Fed can simply do is make credit available to the banks in its system. And what the banks do after that is entirely up to the banks, and that's oftentimes expressed as pushing on a string.
What if the string goes the other way, though, Bob, and the money goes to places the Fed doesn't want it to?
There is concern that this flood of money is pouring into investments right now in commodities. Some critics are even suggesting that what's behind this excessive run-up we've seen in food and oil prices is this flood of money. Wachovia's chief economist John Sylvia does voice some concerns about that and what a sudden flood of money could do to inflation in the future.
You know, you flood the pipeline, somehow not much of it seems to be getting through the hose. And all of a sudden, the day wakes up and everybody says, oh, everything's okay. And then all of a sudden, you got this huge flood coming through. So, yes, there's a risk there.
To explain that further, Kai, the more dollars that flow into the economy, the more those dollars end up being worth less. You're diluting the purchasing power, if you will. People start demanding more dollars to make up their buying power. So the Fed's gambling in a way that all these different moves go according to plan.
Nice to know that Ben Bernanke's gambling.
He is.
Marketplace's senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
As it happens, the Fed made another credit-related move today. It proposed some new rules to protect consumers from fraudulent or deceptive credit card issuers. And credit's gotten some companies in trouble, too. Linens and Things is the most recent example. The company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection today. That'll give it some breathing room while it reorganizes and shuts down about 120 of its stores. Now that homes aren't selling like they used to, neither are new bedspreads and vacuum cleaners, it seems. But our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barshay reports many retailers just couldn't handle their debt.
Linens and Things was bought out by private equity firm Apollo Management in 2006. Apollo saddled the company with more than $1 billion in debt. Brian Bethune is chief U.S. financial economist for Global Insight.
Heavy debt or leverage is a very powerful tool when business is expanding, but it definitely will come back and bite you on the heel when business either is stagnant or even volumes are down.
Most companies that went through a leverage buyout are keeping their heads above water. In fact, investors have been snapping up this risky debt at bargain basement prices in recent weeks. But for the ones in troubled sectors like housing, retail, and autos, making debt payments is especially tough. Diane Vaza heads global fixed income research at Standard & Poor's. She predicts 75 more companies will default on their debts in the next year. That's compared with just 16 companies in all of 2007. Half of them will be ones that went private and loaded up with debt.
I think where it becomes more tangible is when, you know, consumers start to see they're driving by on the highway and, you know, they see that their, you know, retail stores are closing. Now, they might not be shopping there at the moment, but that really brings everything home.
Vaza says the sight of these stores shutting their doors could make consumers pull back more and make the downturn worse. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
There was a bump in commodity prices today. Oil took a step up. Food commodities did, too. But the food story of the day comes courtesy of the federal judiciary. A federal appeals court says Tyson Foods, the country's biggest meat company, needs to find a new way to hawk its chickens. The court's given Tyson 2 weeks to put the brakes on a multi-million-dollar ad campaign, as Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports.
Tyson's antibiotic-free chicken was a huge success. The company sold an extra 70 million pounds of bird. The trouble is, the advertising claims that the birds were drug-free weren't true.
No, it's just a little bit playing loose and free with the truth there, I'd say.
That's Truth in Labeling advocate Craig Winters. He says Tyson's advertising campaign glossed over what was spelled out on the product's labels, that the chickens were actually given a form of antibiotics.
It happens all the time in modern marketing, and you have to be careful. You have to ask a lot of questions and not necessarily assume things.
Tyson's competitors asked a lot of questions last year when they saw the company's claims. Purdue and Sanderson Farms went to court to stop Tyson from marketing its chickens as healthier. John Stauber of PR Watch says Uncle Sam needs to do a better job of holding companies' feet to the fire.
That's why we have to have government regulation and regulation that's enforced, because clearly even getting caught isn't shaming these companies into being honest in their advertising and labeling.
Tyson says it's disappointed with the court's decision, even though it admitted during trial to using various antibiotics. The company says it believes it has acted responsibly and intends to stand its ground. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Traders didn't miss a beat today after that jobs report. We'll have the details and a look back at the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. The Olympic torch had a rare, uneventful relay today. Probably helps that the route was through Hong Kong. Tens of thousands of people turned out to watch peacefully. China's got 3 months, give or take, until the world shows up on its doorstep to see the Games. But in the run-up to the opening ceremony, Beijing's being picky about who it's letting in. Chinese visas are getting harder to come by, and foreign businessmen are crying foul. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
There's a big role for the little guy in China. Western consultants and solo operators who give advice and play middleman. Usually they enter the country on short-term visas and renew them, often in Hong Kong. But the gig may be up. Last month, an American PR consultant tried a standard Hong Kong visa run. He doesn't want to give his name and invite trouble from the immigration authorities.
When I got up to the window, the girl behind the counter was just kind of looking down. She didn't want to look at me directly in the face and said, "We can't give that to you. I'm sorry."
The visa officers said they'd just been told to stop giving out certain business visas. No more multiple entry visas. No more express visas in a hurry.
This was a complete shock. I had no idea that they would change the policy without any public notice.
He wound up stranded in Hong Kong for days, and now he has to fly home to California to fix his papers. And he's out $13,000 in plane tickets and fees his company won't pick up.
A lot of people are just really contemplating just leaving. It really is a shame because the foreigners here are really contributing a lot in money and wealth and support to get this country where it is.
Every day, foreign companies report business trips canceled. At the ongoing Canton Export Fair, China's biggest trade show, one blogger joked, "It's so quiet you can hear, well, you know, crickets." U.S. and European chambers of commerce representing more than 3,000 companies now slammed the visa clampdown as annoying and disruptive, even though Beijing has yet to confirm the policy change and explain why. The best guess is it's heightened security ahead of the Olympics, kind of like post-9/11 rules in the United States. At Shanghai subway stops, bomb-sniffing dogs have turned up, and metal detector checks at the airport are getting stricter. To deal with all these hassles, especially the visas, forward-thinking businesses have actually created hassle departments. Frenchman Charlie Moretti runs a Shanghai film studio.
I have an administration department who deal with my lawyers, and their job is just to make sure that we stay on top of things. And okay, we earn a little bit less money, but, you know, we stay in China, and now I sleep better.
For all the angst over the tighter visa rules, Shanghai business consultant Richard Brubaker likes them. He says the old rules were too loose, and China needs to grow up and start eliminating loopholes, the wiggle room.
You know, we saw a lot of wiggle room in the United States when we were developing. Wiggle room allows for corruption, allows for the end runs to operate.
For businesses, the changing legal landscape means the goalposts keep changing, to which Brubaker says, hey, that's China.
China has had moving goalposts as long as I've been here. I think it's part of what is exciting about this place, to be honest.
Just don't tell that to our PR consultant with the ongoing visa nightmare. How does he get through it?
Sake and beer, the all-you-can-eat Japanese places, are a great release. I've taken numerous walks around the block, and people kind of watch me. It's like, what's he doing? He's walking around in circles.
Anger management for businessmen. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Here we are, that time of the program. The next voice you're going to hear, David Johnson, down in Dallas, Texas. Sir, how are you?
Marvelous. Absolutely marvelous. You know, we had a great April behind us. Now we're off to a good start in May. I think it's going to be all right.
You do? Really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me ask you this then. How come so many people out there, if we were to, you know, go out to Main Street, would say something completely different?
Well, I don't know that everybody would. I think to some degree it depends on what part of the country you're in. Then, subset of that, it depends on what business they're in. Because, I mean, there are depressions out there, and there are a lot of people that are getting along pretty good. But, I mean, this is the dilemma that we've had in this market. And this is one of the reasons the economists and CEOs we talk to and everybody else is, you know, this is one of the most confounding economic scenarios I've ever seen. I still think, really more this week than anything else, is we saw sort of a way out.
All right. Well, run me through that. I mean, obviously, big week. We had the Fed cutting rates. We had the unemployment rate today. Where do you see the way out of that?
Well, I think the Fed did what we hoped it would do when we talked about this last week, which was one and done. Do it. Say, that's probably it. Maybe we don't need it anymore. It's like ringing a bell and saying, okay, everybody in. They're through cutting interest rates. And so then you start, ideally, the bottom fishing. You know, you go into the stock market and try to buy stuff that's beat up, try to do some bargain hunting. We're going to start seeing more and more buyout activity. You saw just a little hint of it with this, you know, big multi-billion dollar deal of Mars buying Wrigley early this week.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
CEO of JCPenney said, you're going to see another 10 or 11 retail casualties through this period. We saw one today, Lennon's and things. But he said, and he's talking about his company, of course, but he said, you know, we're going to come out of this. We're going to be stronger. We're going to be more capable of doing business. It's the evolution.
Yeah, but I'm going to go back to Main Street again, and I'm going to tell you that people are worried about $3.50, $4 gasoline. They're worried about making the mortgages. They're worried about losing their jobs. I mean, 4 months in a row, we learned today the economy's losing jobs.
Well, you know, and of course, the only good thing about that, and believe me, it's a stretch to say it's good, is that nobody's going to go out and do anything that's going to hurt them. They're not going to take on a lot of debt. They're not going to buy a bunch of stuff that they don't need. They're not going to ensconce themselves in, you know, five-bedroom, three-bath homes when a three-plus do will be fine. I mean, this is one of the purges that you have through the economy. But we saw really helpful signs. If the dollar can get stronger, and that in turn pushes oil prices down, which makes that a little more affordable, and then starts sending some money back into the stock market, then we're going to be fine. I don't know when we're going to be fine, but I think we're finer today than we were, you know, a month ago. I know you look finer.
Yeah, I do look good, but I'm not sure I'm buying what you're saying. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kai.
You too. Coming up, consumers just say no.
So I think the FDA is right to try to clarify exactly how pharmaceutical companies can market, but there'll be a broader discussion about this.
But first, let's do the numbers. The blue chip shook off the not good but not horrible jobs numbers and climbed to a new closing high for the year today. The Dow added 48 points, a third of 1%, to finish at 13,058. Weak tech stocks submerged the NASDAQ. It sank 3 points, a tenth of 1%, 2476 was the number. The S&P 500 tacked on 4 points, a third of 1%, wrapped up at 1413. For the week, the Dow gained almost 1.3%. The NASDAQ picked up nearly 2.25%. The S&P 500 rose 1.1% of 1%. Sun's surprising profit decline was a big drag on the NASDAQ. Shares of the fourth largest business computer maker fell more than 22% today. Yahoo stock rallied almost 7% on news the company may be cozying up to the idea of a last-ditch deal with Microsoft after all. Microsoft lost 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, President Bush participates in Cinco de Mayo festivities at the White House. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee holds a hearing on hospital emergency surge capacity. And it's the last day for campaigning before the Indiana primary. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Bolivian President Evo Morales has made no secret of the fact that he's a big fan of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. The two have done trade deals and compared notes about their left-leaning political agendas. Morales has also stolen some pages from his counterpart's domestic playbook. He said yesterday he's going to nationalize Bolivia's biggest telecommunications company and some foreign-owned natural gas companies, too. The timing is no coincidence. Morales is trying to consolidate his economic base ahead of a key provincial election this weekend. From the America's Desk at WLRN in Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Santa Cruz is the wealthiest province in Bolivia, South America's poorest country. That's because Santa Cruz sits on huge natural gas reserves. Tax revenue from the province makes up 40% of Bolivia's national budget. This Sunday, Santa Cruz holds a referendum that would give it greater autonomy from the central government. Autonomy would mean the province could keep some tax revenue from energy firms operating inside its borders, as well as elect its own governor and create a police force. Three other provinces, including the gas-rich Tarija, are planning similar votes in June. Professor Deborah Yashar with Princeton University says Santa Cruz is setting a dangerous precedent for Latin America.
You can imagine that if all regions that were the engines of growth tried to engage in autonomy, increasingly you would have decentralized situations where some regions were extremely productive and others were left to flounder. This is not a way to sustain a stable economy.
President Morales wants to redistribute wealth from the gas-rich eastern lowlands to the indigenous people in the west, and Santa Cruz wants no part of it. Andres Oppenheimer is author of Saving the Americas.
This is a combination of rich people who don't like Evo Morales' socialist, radical, leftist Indian revolution, and working people who are very worried about a centralized country which they don't feel part of.
Sunday's referendum lays bare Bolivia's ideological, ethnic, and class divides. Manuel Rocha is former U.S. ambassador to Bolivia.
Bolivia is a fiction. It is two people that cannot divorce but have stopped sleeping in the same room for a long time.
The Morales government has said it won't recognize the results of Sunday's vote. That sets the stage for street protests, political gridlock, and possibly violence. Meanwhile, foreign energy firms are sitting out the fight. Investment in oil and gas last year hit an 11-year low. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The pharmaceutical industry could probably do with a painkiller or two right about now because it has been a rough couple of weeks. First quarter earnings at GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer were way down. Merck took a beating this week when the Food and Drug Administration said it's not going to approve the company's newest cholesterol pill. The future is none too bright either. Merck and all the rest are staring down an almost empty pipeline. Patents on a lot of blockbuster drugs are expiring and there's precious little coming to replace them. So, the industry is working on new ways to make money. Some say new ways that are too creative, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
One way the drug companies are trying to make money, off-label prescribing. Take a seizure medicine. Once the FDA approves it, it can be prescribed for anything, say a mood disorder. It's illegal for drug companies to market off-label uses to doctors, but the FDA is working on new guidelines that would let drug company reps give doctors journal articles about off-label uses. Briggs Morrison is a doctor and senior vice president at Pfizer. He argues the medical journal articles will help busy doctors.
Anything that we can do to increase physicians' awareness of new science and medicine is a good thing.
What doctors may not be aware of is that some of those positive articles are ghostwritten by the drug companies themselves. That's what Dr. Joseph Ross found when he led a study on medical ghostwriting. He says in the best cases, the drug companies provide information to independent experts and then get out of the way. But
who knows how often that actually happens? The worst case scenario is a company says, we'll have a medical publishing company handle everything. They'll write the papers. We'll approve it before we even send it to the doctors. Then we'll let the doctors lightly edit it if they want to. And then we'll send it out with their names on top.
Nobody in the industry openly endorses that approach. In fact, the Association of American Medical Colleges recently put together a panel that included chief executives from several big drug firms. The panel recommended that drug companies be banned from ghostwriting for doctors. Les Funtleiter is a pharmaceutical industry analyst.
So I think the FDA is right to try to clarify exactly how pharmaceutical companies can market, but there'll be a broader discussion about this.
In the meantime, the pharmaceutical industry has some other big problems, like figuring out what it's going to do for revenues when its best-selling drugs come off patent. Once a patent expires, 80% of the drug company's profits are lost to generics. To get some of that money back, the companies have started to license their branded formulas to generic manufacturers, allowing them to copy the drugs exactly. Then these so-called authorized generics are marketed as superior to standard generics. Some consumers are willing to pay more for a brand they know. Merck did this with its osteoporosis drug, Fosamax.
The good news is, if osteoporosis is detected early enough, its effects may be prevented.
Fosamax brought in $3 billion for Merck last year. Sales this year could drop to about $1 billion. The authorized generic Fosamax costs half what the branded version does, but Merck will take what it can get. Drug companies are also trying to prolong the life of their patents. They'll tweak formulas to create new versions of a drug they can patent. Or they'll combine old drugs with new medications and patent that. This nipping and tucking is known as drug lifecycle management. Industry analyst Funtleiter is not impressed.
A lot of lifecycle management efforts are the pharmaceutical equivalent of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
But Pfizer's Briggs Morrison says it hasn't come to that yet.
The ship is actually quite stable and doing very well.
Briggs Morrison says Pfizer is investing more than $7 billion into research and development, but it could be years before the next blockbuster. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, just when Hollywood and its television-watching audience was getting over the writers' strike, there are developments today in another labor dispute out here. Producers have been talking with the Screen Actors Guild for a couple of months now, trying to iron out their differences before their contract runs out this summer. Talks seemed to be at a standstill last night, but the actors blinked this morning. There are reports this afternoon the Guild has backed off its demands for higher residuals from DVD sales and in a couple of other areas, too. Talks are going to resume on Tuesday, we are told. This, though, is Friday, and that means we got to go. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 48 points, a third of 1%, a new closing high for the year if you're keeping track. The NASDAQ dropped 3 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 gained 4 points. That's a third percent there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, political stump speeches and the race for space.
There'll be dozens of smaller decisions having to do with space technologies and how they affect our day-to-day life. And a president will have to make those.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.